I say unto you, lecture number 13, 4th of November, 1977, at the Bhagwan Shirajni's Ashram, Pune.
Bhagwan. And he came to Capernaum, and being in the house, he asked them, "What was it that ye disputed amongst yourselves by the way?" But they held their peace, for by the way they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12, and saith unto them, "If any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all, and servant of all." And he took a child, and set him in the midst of them. And when he had taken him in his arms, he said unto them, "Whosoever shall receive one of these children in my name, receiveth me. And whosoever shall receiveth me, receiveth not me, but him that sent me." Then said the Jews unto him, "Art thou greater than our father Abraham, which is dead, and the prophets are dead? Whom makest thou thyself?" Jesus answered, "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it, and was glad." Then said the Jews unto him, "Thou art not yet 50 years old, and hast thou seen Abraham?" Jesus said unto them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am."
The ego is subtle, its ways are subtle, its working is very complex. It is a puzzle, and a puzzle that cannot be solved, that can only be seen through and through, but cannot be solved. There is no solution for it. Because the puzzle is not anything accidental to the ego. The ego itself is the puzzle. If it was accidental, then there was a way to solve it. Ego itself is the puzzle. It is its nature to be puzzling. So all the efforts that are made to solve it make it more complex, make it more difficult. If you fight with it, you are fighting with yourself. There can be never any victory. You cannot defeat it by fighting. Because by fighting you will be dividing yourself into two, the fighter and the fought. And from where you will bring the fought? It will be just ego dividing into two parts, playing the game of fight. Sometimes one part being yourself into two, the fighter and the fought. And from where you will bring the fought? It will be just ego dividing into two parts, playing the game of fight. Sometimes one part can pretend to win, sometimes the other part can pretend to win, but nobody ever wins. The struggle becomes infinite. And meanwhile, energy is dissipated. Meanwhile, life is wasted. Remember, you cannot fight the ego. Can you repress it? People have done that too. It has not helped. If you repress the ego, it goes deeper into your being. Rather than getting rid of it, you become more and more poisoned by it. Because what you will do when you will repress, you will force it into the unconscious. It will start going underground. But the unconscious is far more powerful than the conscious. Ego in the conscious has not much power. Once it enters into the unconscious, it becomes 9 times more powerful than it was before. Rather than getting rid of it, you will be more and more in its control. It has gone behind you. Now, you cannot even watch it. You are completely a victim now. Now you cannot protect yourself against it. Now you cannot make any arrangements to save yourself from it. It is there, pulling your strings from the behind. You will become a puppet. And you will be in the hands of the ego. And you were thinking that you have repressed it. Fight does not help. Repression does not help. Then the third thing that has been tried down the ages is sublimation. Sublimate it. Let it be identified with higher goals. Then it becomes very decorated. It becomes enthroned. And naturally, it becomes again very powerful. Identify it with your church. Identify it with your country. Identify it with your color. Identify itself with ideology, socialism, communism, fascism, Christianity, Hinduism. Identify it with some high value, some utopian value, or even you can identify it with God. Then it rules supreme most. Then in the name of God it rules. God is just an excuse. The real sovereign becomes the ego. And these are the 3 available ways. Either fight or repress or sublimate. And nothing helps. Nothing can help. Because from the very nature, the ego is such that solutions are not possible. I have heard a mother is standing in a toy shop and she says, "Is not this a rather complicated toy for a small child?" The toy salesman says, "This, madam, is an educational toy, especially designed to adjust the child to live in the world of today. No matter which way he puts it together, it is always wrong." And that's how the ego is. No way will ever bring you out of it. There is no remedy. To see it is to be on the right path. To see the complexity, the riddling nature of the ego, the puzzling nature of the ego, to comprehend it in its totality is the beginning of wisdom. Otherwise it will come, and it will come in more subtle forms, and you will be deceived far more deeply. The so-called religious person is deceived by it because it comes hiding behind religious curtains. Sometimes it becomes humbleness. Sometimes it becomes humility. Sometimes it can even pretend egolessness. It can say that I am absolutely egoless. And it is there. And now it has protected itself perfectly. You will not even suspect its existence. Watch the so-called religious people and you will see a great game of the ego. The ego is there. It has become pious. Mm-hmm. But when the ego becomes pious, it becomes more poisonous. It is pious poison. It corrupts you deeply. The ordinary grass ego is not such a big problem. You can see it, it is there. Even the person who is its victim knows it is there. The disease is known. But when it becomes pious, it takes religious garb, then even the victim is unaware. He lives in its imprisonment and thinks that he is free. Start finding a remedy and you will be in more and more trouble. Why? Because most remedies are imposed. Why most? All the remedies are imposed. You find them from somewhere outside. You find the clues from somebody else. You see a Buddha. He looks so humble. He is. His humbleness is there. You see his face, his simplicity, his utter innocence. And a clue is found. Maybe this is the way to get rid of the ego. This is not the way. It is a consequence. Something has happened in him which has made him egoless. You cannot copy his behavior and can become egoless. Copying the behavior will simply make you a carbon copy. The ego will not disappear. You can eat the same food Buddha takes. You can walk the same way Buddha walks. You can imitate him perfectly. You can become very skillful in imitation and still the ego will be there. Because there is no way to see what has happened into Buddha's innermost core. All that you can watch is behavior. That's why a certain school of psychologists, behaviorists, go on saying that there is no soul in man. Man is only behavior. They are following a certain logic. The logic is that only the behavior can be watched, observed. The soul has never been watched, never has been observed. Nobody has seen it. Then how to accept that it exists? Anything that exists must be seen. Only that which is seen exists. Have you ever seen anybody's soul? All that you see is his behavior. And still you know that your behavior is not you. But that is an inner introspection. Inside you know that my behavior is not me. Because many times the behavior is there and you are totally different from the behavior. You see a man coming to your house and you smile. And you know that you are not smiling. That smile is false. Just polite, just part of etiquette. You have to smile, so you smile. But deep down there is no smile. Now from the outside, you are smiling. That is your behavior. The behaviorist is finished there. But from the inner, you are not smiling at all. That is your soul. That is you. More real you. Not just a soul, but authentically you. You go on doing 1001 things out on the outside, and the inside may be different, may be far more different, may be even polar opposite to your behavior. But this is introspection. it cannot be an objective observation. You look at the Buddha, you watch his behavior. From his behavior, you start taking cues. You see Jesus, you watch, you start taking notes in your mind. This is the way to sit, this is the way to stand, this is the way to walk, this is the way to sleep and eat, and these are the things to eat. This is how Jesus prays, standing on his knees, so you kneel down. These are the words that Jesus speaks when he prays. He looks at the sky and says, Father, Abba, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. And you say, so I know prayer. You can kneel down. Millions of people kneel down every morning, every night, all around the globe. And they repeat the same words that Jesus said, Abba, give us our daily bread. And they go on repeating. And nothing happens. Millions of people praying are simply wasting their time. Because it is pretension. It is not prayer. They have learned a behavior. But their soul is not in prayer. And the question is not how to pray. The question is not what to pray. Just the other night, Gramya was asking me that since she has become a sannyasin, she does not know whom she is praying to. But the prayer is there. Now she is a little puzzled. She asked me whether I am praying to God or I am praying to you, Bhagwan, or to whom. I don't know anything about God now. And I told her, this is a far better prayer. Vague, cloudy, but more alive. Now the prayer is not addressed to anybody in particular. It is not even addressed to God. So how it can be addressed to Christian God? It is unaddressed. It is simply an overflow of joy, thankfulness, gratitude. Gratitude for the whole, for the total. It is a kind of thankfulness. Now, it will not matter much what words you use or whether you use words at all. Silence will do. Sometimes gibberish will do. What Christians call talking in tongues. That will do. That will be far better. Sometimes just enjoying sounds like a small child, gaga. That will do. The whole question is the prayerful attitude, the inner quality of prayer, that you are surrendered. That you are no more separate from the whole. Now this remedy cannot be imposed from the outside. Otherwise you will be simply doing empty postures, empty gestures, perfect from the outside and not at all breathing from the inside, not at all vital and alive. Prayer is a state, not a ritual. Prayer is a state of inner silence, humbleness, love, gratitude, surrender, let go. It has nothing to do with the outer formulations of it. But all remedies come from the outside. And people go on changing remedies. One fails, they immediately jump to another. That fails, they go on. From one guru to another guru, from one remedy to another remedy, from one scripture to another scripture, from one temple to another temple, they go on and on, and not seeing the real fact that no remedy is possible, that no remedy exists, that to search for the remedy is to search in vain. And why? Because remedies are imposed from the outside, either by somebody else or by yourself. And whatsoever is imposed from the outside is an intrusion, interference in your natural being, intrusion on your natural selves. They are manipulations that create three selves, where previously there was only one self. Previously there was only one ego. If you use some remedy, there will be three egos. You have multiplied the problem. You have made it more difficult. Now it will be far more impossible for you to get out of it. And if you bring another remedy, you will have 9 egos instead of 3. Each remedy will bring 3 egos instead of 1. And people have used many remedies, and they have become many egos. Mahavira has used the right word for it. He calls man bahuchittavan, polypsychic. Man is not one mind, but many minds. And that is the research of the modern psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, psychologist too. Man is polypsychic. It is not one ego that you are carrying inside. You are carrying many egos. Egos upon egos. They are standing in a queue. They are surrounding you from every side. They are like a crowd. You are lost in the crowd. You don't know who you are, because there are so many pretenders around you who say, "This is you. I am you. Where you are looking? I am yourself." Every desire, every fragment of your mind claims to be the master. And that's how your slavery is created. Each remedy brings 3 egos into your being instead of 1. How it happens? In accepting a remedy, you become the you who is, plus the you who is helping you become other than the you who is, plus the you whom you hope to become. The one that you were, now the goal that you want to become, egoless, and the remedy, the help that you are trying to pull yourself towards the goal, you are divided in 3. And this division is not going to help. It will confuse you. It will make you more and more dull, insensitive, insane, neurotic, schizophrenic. The remedy proves far more dangerous than the disease itself. So the first thing to be understood, the ego is the basic problem that anybody who is searching for his real self has to face. Now, it cannot be countered by anything outside. No remedy is going to help. No medicine is going to help. No method is going to help. Then, is not there any way to get out of it? There is a way, but it cannot be imposed from the outside. And the way is not like a remedy. The way is clarity, transparency, to look through and through, to watch the ego, how it functions, to see its subtle games. You throw it out from the front door, and it has come back from the back doors. You throw it from one side, it starts posing itself from another side. You think you have got rid of it, suddenly you find it is there sitting inside. So without any contamination, the ego has to be looked into through and through, with no idea that you want to drop it. That conclusion will be a hindrance. That conclusion means that you have decided beforehand, you have looked into it. So go into the ego with no conclusion, with no idea what you want to do. Just with one idea that you would like to understand this mystery of the ego, what it is. All the religions say it is the hindrance. All the great masters say it has to be got rid of. All the mystics say nothing is barring your path except your ego. But you don't know what this ego is. So first thing, go innocently into it, just to watch its ways. Its ways are very mechanical. The first thing that you will come across is its mechanicalness. The ego is not an organic whole. It is mechanical. Because it consists of the dead past. Your ego consists of your past. And if sometimes your ego thinks of the future, that too is nothing but the projection of the past and from the past. Maybe a little modified, sophisticated, decorated, but it is the same thing. You desire the same pleasure that you had had in the past. Of course, you hope to make them a little better. Your past goes on projecting itself into the future. And past is dead. And past is just memory. And that's all ego consists of. So the first experience, if you go into the ego without any conclusion, will be this, that you will be able to see it is mechanical. And you are an organic unity. You are an alive phenomenon and ego is dead. And the dead is ruling the alive. That's why people look so heavy and dragging. Their life seems to be nothing but a long story of boredom, monotonousness. It is not the quality of life. Boredom is not the quality of life. Boredom is there because life is too much burdened by the death. Life is too much burdened by the dead. And the grave goes on becoming bigger and bigger. And life is encroached from every side. The first experience and a great revealing experience is to see that ego is your past. It is not your present. Ego is never found in the present. If you go into it, you will be surprised. Right this moment, if you go into yourself, you will not find any ego. And if you will find, that will be just fragments from the past floating in the present consciousness. The present consciousness is always egoless. And that is your reality. But the past consciousness, which is not consciousness at all, but memory, is dead. And that's what your ego consists of. Your nation, your family, your education, your experiences, your certificates, all that is no more there. It has gone down the drain. It exists not, but it goes on influencing your mind. It can destroy your whole life. I have heard a future story. Male robot. Hello. 164,259. Female robot. You can call me 164 if you like. I am sorry. I am a bit late, but I was screwing on a new face. Male robot. That's A-okay. I was a bit late too. I blew a sprocket. Female robot, how nasty. Male robot, might have been worse. I thought my big end had gone. My own fault though. I went out last night and got oiled. Female robot, still you had better go down to the garage for a checkup. You might have a dirty sparking plug. I have had some trouble too. My employers programmed me to do the wages, but I gave out the horse racing results. I have got a new operator now. Male robot, was the other one sacked? Female robot, no, retired on his winnings. Hope it does not happen again. Male robot, I expect one of your vogels worked loose. And talking about vogels, that is, what is this about your sister? Female robot, we don't talk about her. She has eloped with a petrol pump. Male robot, that is the spirit. Not as bad as my brother though. He fell in love with a robot with three eyes. We did not have the heart to tell him it was a traffic light. Eventually, she blew a fuse, and he did not know whether to stop or to go. Actually, now we are alone. I have got a present for you. Female robot, it is wonderful. What is it? Male robot, I bought it at the Geiger counter. Female robot, but what it is? Male robot, a Geiger counter. It comes in useful if you go Geiger hunting. They say it is made especially for girls. It is a Geiger. It is a girl Geiger. Female robot, you are so wonderful, so magnetic. Male robot, you are only saying that because you are attracted to me. Let us run away and get married. Female robot, but I have had my heart broken before. Look, you can see where it has been soldered. Male robot, but this time it will be different. Female robot, how do you know? Male robot, I can feel it in my transistors. So they were joined together in welded bliss and lived mechanically ever after. This is a future story, but the past also, and the present too. This is your story. This is the story of the ego. The mechanical, the robot-like thing that has overpowered you. You are not alive. Are only so-so alive in a lukewarm way. Because the ego does not allow you to be alive. It goes on pulling you towards the past. And remember, past is growing every day bigger. Because every moment that passes becomes the past. So the ego goes on becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. The child has a smaller ego. The old man has a bigger ego. And that's the difference between a child and an old man. The child is closer to God. The old man is far away. And the old man, if he wants to be closer to God, will have to become a child again. Why Jesus says again and again that unless you are like a child, you will not enter into my kingdom of God. Why? He is saying that unless you become alive again like a child who has no past. A child means one who has no past. An old man means one who has nothing but the past. The more you become old, the past goes on becoming bigger and bigger, and the future starts disappearing. The child has future, the old man has past. The child thinks of the future, the old man simply remembers his past, goes in the nostalgia of the past. Always remembers how things were in the good old days. And always goes on fantasizing that his past was tremendously beautiful. It is more or less imagination, consolation. As you become older, you will be getting more and more burdened by the past. And then, before even death happens, you are dead. Those who know, they say people die near about 30, then they are buried near about 70. 40 years, they live a dead life. The hippies are right when they say, don't trust a man above 30. There is some truth in it. Because the man who is above 30 is less and less alive. His investment is more in the dead past. He is no more a rebel. He is no more free. He is no more responding to the present. His spontaneity is gone. Everything has become fixed. He has become very knowledgeable. He goes on repeating his knowledge. And he goes on behaving in the past old ways, which are not to the contest at all, which are not relevant. But he goes on. And nothing works in his life, because nothing can work. Each moment life is new. And you have to respond from your inner newness. You have to be available to the new, as the new. And you have to respond not out of your knowledge, but of your present awareness. Only then life works. Otherwise life stops working. If your life is not working, remember, it is the ego that is hindering. The mechanical has encroached upon the organic. To be free from the mechanical is to be in God, because it is in to be the organic unity of existence. What has to be done? You have to watch. You have to learn the ways of the ego. Walking on the road, watch how the ego comes in. Somebody insults you, watch. Don't miss that opportunity. How the ego raises its head. How the ego swells up suddenly. Somebody praises you, see how you become like a balloon and you go on becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. Just to go on watching in different situations, in different moments, what happens to your ego. And there is no hurry to conclude. It is a complicated matter. It is one of the greatest problems. The greatest, in fact. Because if it is solved, God is available immediately. That very moment you are in God, and God is in you. So it is a serious problem. And you cannot be in a hurry. You have to go very slowly, very carefully, so that nothing is missed. Just for a few months, watch your ego. And you will be surprised. You will be surprised that the ego can control you only if you are not aware of it. The moment you become aware of a certain functioning of the ego, that functioning disappears. Just by sheer awareness, that functioning disappears. Wherever you put your light of consciousness, ego disappears. Then you have got the real key. Now go on bringing more and more light to your ego functioning. And one day you will see it has disappeared from everywhere. You have not repressed it, so it cannot bubble up again. You have not been fighting with it, not at all. So you are not giving any energy to it. In fight, you give energy. You have not been sublimating it. You are not making a divine ego. You have not done anything with it. You are simply watching. Watching is not a doing. And the miracle is that by non-doing, the ego disappears. In fact, to say it disappears is not right. I have to use language. So many times I have to use incorrect expressions because they are prevalent and there is no other language. When I say it disappears, I mean it is not found. It was never there. It was invented. It was just our ignorance. It was just our unawareness that has allowed it to exist. Now the sutras. And he came to Capernaum, and being in the house, he asked them, "What was it that you disputed among yourselves by the way?" And this is an ugly story about Jesus' disciples, or maybe the story of all kinds of disciples that have existed in the world. The disciples of Jesus were continuously arguing, who is the greatest amongst them? Who is the topmost? Who is closest to Jesus? Not only that, when Jesus will die and will go to his Father who is in heaven, and when we will die, who will be there with Jesus? The closest. Of course, he will be standing by the right side of God. He will be the right hand of God. Who will be the right hand of Jesus? Who amongst us? Those 12 were continuously arguing. This is a subtle ego game. Even when you are around a man like Jesus, you go on thinking about your ego. How you are going to meet this man Jesus? It is impossible. Your ego will function like an iron curtain. These disciples are not enjoying the presence of Jesus. Their whole worry is, who is the topmost of them all? The same old ambitious minds, the same old games of the ego, the same old politics. Nothing has changed, it seems. They are the same people. If they were in politics, they would have been thinking, who is going to become the president of the country? It is the same old game. Now they are thinking, who is to become the first? Who is the closest to Jesus? Who is his chief disciple? The same ambition, the same throat-cut competition, the same fight, the same violence. Of course, now in the name of religion, in the name of disciplehood, in the name of spirituality, but nothing has changed. Ego has entered from the back door. And Jesus has said many times to them, but they won't listen. Even in the last night, when Jesus was taking leave forever, This was the last time that they will see him. Tomorrow morning he will be crucified. The Last Supper. But still they were arguing. They are going to lose Jesus forever. It may be for millions of lives that they may not be able to find such a man again. But they are not worried about that. They are not worried about Jesus' death. They are worried about their positions in heaven. Jesus is leaving. Now what about us? What will be our position? The last thing they ask Jesus is this. That's why I say it is an ugly story. But ego is ugly. It is a monster. And if you are under its impact, you become ugly. You become a monster. I have heard one day a man dashed into the space police station, threw himself onto the counter and gasped, "Officer, officer, we have just been attacked by a creature from outer space. Officer, now sir, can you describe what happened?" "Man, well, it was like this, officer. I was out for a walk on the common with my mother-in-law when the creature, suddenly appeared in front of us and made a grab for my mother-in-law." "Officer, could I have a description, sir?" "Man, well, that is green, glaring eyes, two big yellow fang teeth, hair like knotted barbed wire, and an ambling, fat, ugly, sloth-like body." "Officer, how terrible." "Man, yes, and wait until I tell you about the monster. Just now he was telling about his mother-in-law. That monster of the ego is making you ugly. That monster of the ego is possessing you from everywhere. Your life is not beautiful because of it. And it goes on in new ways, in new shapes, in new sizes. Remember, the ego comes in all shapes and all sizes. To everybody's requirements. Whatsoever fits you, ego is ready to fit with you. It is very, very adjusting. If you become religious, it becomes religious and adjusts with you. If you become humble, it becomes humble and adjusts with you. If you become a disciple, it becomes a disciple and adjusts with you. It is very cooperative. It never creates any difficulty for you in that way. Wherever you go, it simply follows you. It does not create any sounds. It is very silent. Not even the footsteps are heard. It goes on working very silently, but goes on poisoning you. Now think of these disciples. And he came to Capernaum. And being in the house, he asked them, on the road, he must have thought, "It is not right to ask my disciples before other people. It looks so ugly. My disciples, and thinking about who is the greatest, and who is the topmost, and who is the real disciple, and the chief disciple, who is next to Jesus?" And remember, the person who wants to be next to Jesus, if he is made next to Jesus, will try to become even more important than Jesus. That's what really happened. Judas was the most knowledgeable disciple. Judas was the only sophisticated and educated disciple of Jesus. All others were very common and ordinary men. Only Judas was of any worth, naturally. He tried many times in life to correct Jesus. Many times he argued with Jesus. Many times he advised Jesus, do this, don't do that. He was deep down the competitor. And this has happened always. One of Buddha's brothers got initiated by Buddha. Devadatta was his name. He is the Judas of Buddha's story. He was very much educated as Buddha. Came from the same family. Royal blood, great heritage, noble family. And he was as much educated as Buddha and as much cultured, sophisticated, philosophical, maybe even more than Buddha. Now it was very difficult for him to think himself as second to Buddha. He created the lift. He started making his own group. He started initiating people himself. He betrayed. He tried to kill Buddha so that he can dominate the Buddha community, the disciples of Buddha. He wanted to become the leader. Buddha was poisoned once by him. Once a rock was thrown from the mountain. Underneath, Buddha was meditating. Just by inches, he was saved. Then a mad elephant was brought to Buddha and left alone with Buddha. The elephant was so mad, he had killed many people. But even elephants are more loving, more compassionate than Devadattas and Judas. The elephant looked at this silent man. Something happened into him. He bowed down and touched the feet of Buddha. Even the mad elephant was not so mad as the ego is mad. Judas was always feeling that he can be the leader. And he can be the leader in a far better way. He knows better than Jesus. Maybe that rivalry, that ego conflict, created in his mind the desire to destroy Jesus. Once Jesus is removed, he will be the topmost man. But others are also not very different. Of course, they don't say that we are bigger than Jesus, but they want to say, certainly, and let it be decided before Jesus leaves, who is the greatest among them. This is our whole life's struggle. Who is the greatest? And we waste our life in this struggle. This is politics, this is not religion. Wherever ego is, there is politics. Once the ego goes, then there is no politics. Then you don't compare yourself with anybody. Because each individual is incomparable. Each individual is unique. So unique, comparison is not possible. You don't put yourself higher and you don't put yourself lower. You are simply different. There is no question of putting higher and lower. You are you and somebody else is somebody else. There is no question of comparison. Remember, when ego disappears, comparison disappears. And when comparison disappears, competitiveness disappears. And there arises great peace. What is your anxiety? what it is that creates anguish in you, competition, comparison, conflict. The effort to be the greatest, to be the first. And everybody is trying to be the first, hence the warlike quality that surrounds society. Everybody is your enemy. Even those who are your friends are your enemies, because they are also fighting for the first place as you are fighting. How can you be friendly? With the ego, there is no possibility of friendship. Then friendship is just a mask. The real nature of life is that of jungles. The big fish goes on eating the small fish. Even if you pretend to be friendly, that is just so, strategy, diplomacy. Nobody can be a friend here unless the ego disappears. Once the ego disappears, the whole life has a quality of friendship, of love. Then you are friendly, simply friendly, and to everybody, because there is no problem. You are not trying to be the first, so you are no more a competitor. This is real drop out. You can drop out from the school, from the college, from the university. That is not going to help. In your hippie community, you will try to be the first. To be the hippiest amongst the hippies. But then it is the same. It makes no difference. You have created another society and you have started playing the same games again. The same comparison, the same competition. Just see, Jesus' disciples, they were so fortunate to be allowed to live with Jesus so closely, but yet the old mind continues. That's why I say ego is very subtle. And he came to Capernaum, and being in the house, he asked them. It would have looked ugly for him to mention the subject that they were discussing on the way. They must have discussed the whole way. That was their basic problem. They were not interested in kingdom of God. They were not interested in meditation. They were not interested in prayer. They were not interested in Christ and Christ consciousness. Their whole interest was, who I am, where I stand, am I the first or not? What was it, Jesus asked, that you disputed among yourself by the way? He must have asked this many times. This story is a condensed story, representative of many stories. It must have been a daily thing. It was so with Buddha, it was so with Mahavira. Mahavira's chief disciple betrayed him. First he tried to become the chief. His name was Gosala. Once he started feeling that he is the chief, then the problem was how to topple Mahavira. This is how the ego goes. Then he went against Mahavir. The ego is dangerous. To be against a man like Mahavir seems inconceivable. If you cannot be even with a man like Mahavir, Buddha, Jesus, then you cannot be anywhere. Then you cannot be in love ever. What was it that you disputed among yourselves by the way, Jesus asked? But they did held their peace. They remained silent. Not that they were silent. How can the egoistic mind be silent? They were full of turmoil. There was no peace in their mind. Their mind was in pieces. There was no peace. They were not together at all. But why they kept silent? Because it has happened many times before too. And each time they are caught. And Jesus says something which hurts. But again and again they fall in the trap back. The ego comes back in certain ways. It is so subtle that you may not be even aware that it comes. You have to be very, very careful, then only you will know. Because it comes like a whisper. It does not shout. It arises its head so silently that nothing stirs. Once it has taken possession of you, then it is very difficult. Those disciples must have felt again and again embarrassed. But again and again they will forget Jesus. Jesus was walking with them on the road. Maybe he was a little ahead. And they were following at the back. Or maybe they were a little ahead and he was following. But there must have been a little gap. And that gap helped them to discuss again their basic problem, who is the greatest. Jesus must have seen it, must have seen on their faces. And when they kept silence, when they remained quiet, Jesus said, "For by the way they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest." Jesus knew what they were discussing. It was not necessary for Jesus to listen what they were discussing. He knew it. That was their basic problem continuously. And as the days were coming close for Jesus' death, they were becoming more and more agitated. Who will be the head when Jesus is gone? As if deep down they wanted Jesus to go. So somebody amongst them can be the head. The mind is very cunning. The mind is very violent. But they held their peace, for by the way, they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12 and saith unto them, "If any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all and servant of all." This he was saying again and again. But who listens? This he was repeating every day. But people are deaf. And they have seen this man Jesus, who has become the first because he has become the last. He has come to the top because he has become capable of remaining at the last. He was saying again and again that the first will be the last in my kingdom of God, and the last should be the first. But mind has its own calculations. Sometimes the mind says, okay, if the first should be the last in your kingdom of God, and the last should be the first, then I will try to be the last so I can be the first. But this is the same game. You miss the point. Logically, you have understood. But spiritually, you have missed. Now, a person can even try to be the last. Can make all kinds of endeavors to be the last. Can torture himself to be the last, in order to be the first, then he is not the last. Because it is the same desire and the same ambition. When Jesus says, those who are the last should be the first, he is not giving you a strategy. He is not giving you a technique how to be the first. He is simply stating a fact. This has to be understood. Sometimes people come to me and they want to go into meditation. They really want to go into meditation. But they have motives. They say, if we go into meditation, should we see God? I say to them that if you have a motivation like that, meditation will not happen. Because a motivated mind can never be meditative. Motivation is desire. Desire is disturbance. How can you meditate with disturbance? Meditation is possible only when you are unmotivated. You don't have any desire. When there is no desire, there is meditation. Meditation is a state of desirelessness. They understand logically and they say, okay, so we will drop the motive. Now, if we drop the motive, will it be possible for us to see God? They are ready to drop the motive, but the motive is still there. It has slipped deep down in the unconscious. They say, okay, if you say so, if this is the condition to be fulfilled, we will fulfill. But are you certain? Then we will see God. So where the motive has gone, it is still there. It has gone underground. Jesus was saying again and again, those who are the last will be the first. This is simply a statement. A simple statement. It is not a question of cause and effect. He is not saying that if you want to be the first, be the last. He is saying, if you are the last, you will be the first. And there is a great difference between these two. Linguistically, not much. Logically, not much. You will say, what is the difference? Say this way or that. But existentially, there is such a big difference. Be the last. Enjoy being the last. And not that by being the last you will be the first. By being last with such joy, you are already the first. Now where else you can be? What higher state you can be? Standing the last. Enjoying it. Because to stand in the last is a very, very beautiful space. Because nobody competes with it. Nobody comes and struggles with you. You are the last already. Lao Tzu used to say that I am the last. That's why I am the most peaceful. Because nobody comes to fight with me. Who is ready to fight with the last? Everybody has compassion with the last. And everybody feels poor man. And who is ambitious to be the last? Nobody comes and throws him off his place. If you are the last, you are left alone. Then you are never disturbed by anybody. Then you can simply be yourself. And when you are the last, you can be in the present, never otherwise. If you want to be the first, you will have to remain in the future. Because you will have to think how to be the first, how to drag people who are already there out of their places so you can make some place for yourself, how to fight, how to manage, what to do, what not to do. You will be in the future. To try to be the first is to be in the future. And if you want to be the first, you will have to project, worry about the future, and from where you will got your ideas? From the past. So you will remain in the past and in the future, and you will go on missing the present. And present is the only thing that really is. Now is the only real time. A man who is ready to stand at the last, not as a strategy to go to the first, But just as the understanding that it is foolish and is stupid to compete, what is the point of it all? Why not enjoy life? You can do only one thing. Either you can compete, or you can enjoy, or you can fight. Either you can love, or you can struggle. Both together are not possible. So the person who stands at the last, not as a desire to be the first, but as an understanding that to be the first is just the stupidity of the minds, the mediocre minds, the foolish minds. Seeing the foolishness of it, seeing the uselessness of it, seeing the people who are standing first and looking like hell, in that very understanding, one has become the first. Can you see it? Do you understand it? In understanding that one has become the first, this is the meaning of Jesus. And he sat down and called the 12 and said unto them, if any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all. Now, the language creates trouble. You can misinterpret Jesus' language. If any man desire to be first, he says, the same shall be last of all. Then he has to become the last. But the language can be dangerous. He uses the word desire. If any man desire to be the first, and those are all, those 12 are desiring to be the first, they can again get a clue out of it. They can say, okay, so I will be the last because I want to be the first. Jesus says, one who wants to be the first. So this is the way to be the first. I will do all that I can do. I will do all that I can do to be the first. Even if it is needed to stand at the last, I will stand. I will suffer that. But I have to be the first. Then the message is missed. To be the last means no desire for being first. That is the meaning. To be the last means all comparison has been dropped. All competition has been dropped. All aggression, arrogance has been dropped. One starts enjoying this moment, the peace, the bliss of it, the benediction of it. One is in sheer delight. Because one can breathe. Because one can see the flowers. Because one can watch the birds. One can listen to the song of the birds. Or the rain falling on the roof. Or the smell of the wet earth. A small thing. Jesus says, look at the lilies in the fields, they toil not. They think not of the morrow. And how beautiful, how incredibly beautiful they are. Even Solomon was not so beautiful, attired in all his precious dresses, sitting on his golden throne, studded with diamonds. And these poor flowers of lilies, just standing alone in the fields. Look how beautiful they are. How silent, how blissful, how meditative, how prayerful. What is the beauty of the flowers? They are non-competitive. What is the beauty of the stars? They are non-competitive. What is the beauty of existence? It is not competing. It is not going anywhere. It is not trying to be something else that it is not. It is there where man has gone wrong, has gone insane. To exist with the ego is to exist in a kind of neurosis. It is a state of madness. It is the original fall. To be in the ego is to be a sinner. To be not in the ego is to become a saint. But remember again, I am not saying become a saint. Otherwise, ego comes back and says, look, I am such a great saint. Look, I don't think of the morrow. Look, I am no more worried with any competition. Then the ego has arisen again. Then there can be a competition. If somebody else is trying to be the last, you will fight with him. That what are you doing? I am the last. You cannot be the last. You can be second to me, but you cannot go ahead of me. I have heard in a synagogue, a great king was praying early in the morning. The rabbi was there to accompany the king. It was dark. And a beggar has also entered. The king prayed and said, God, I am nobody. I am just a nothingness. And the rabbi also prayed and he also said, God, I am nobody. I am just nothingness. And then they heard the beggar who was just standing there. And he also prayed and he said, God, I am nobody. I am just nothingness. And the king said to the rabbi, look, who is trying to be nobody? Look. Who is pretending to be nothingness? A beggar? How you dare? Before a king, when I am saying I am nothing, nobody, and a beggar dares to pretend that he is also nobody, nothing. This is offensive. This can happen. Then you can start fighting who is the last, and the same game. Only the names have changed. Be very careful when you listen to a Buddha, Jesus. Be very careful because they have to use your language. It is a necessary evil. But try to be very careful that so that you don't misunderstand them. Jesus says, if any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all and servant of all. And Christians missed it. And they started becoming servants of all. Service became the key word. And the Christian missionary has become a servant. He runs the hospital, the school, the orphanage. He goes on serving people. But look into his eyes. Look on his nose is sitting the ego that I am the servant of the people. That nobody is serving the people as I am serving. A story I have heard, a very beautiful story. In China, in some village, there was a great fair. And a man fell in a well. Because there was no wall surrounding the well to protect. So he shouted from the well, save me. And there comes a Buddhist monk. He looks down. And the man is crying. He says, what are you looking? Do something. I am dying. And the Buddhist monk said, listen to me. Buddha has said, birth is suffering. Life is suffering. Death is suffering. All is suffering. So what is the difference whether you are suffering in a well or somewhere else? Accept it. Buddha has said, tathata. Accept. In acceptance, there is deliverance. But the man prayed and he said, I will listen to your sermon, but first, please take me out, then you can bore me as much as you want. But right now, this is no moment, and I am not in a state to listen to your great philosophy. But the Buddhist monk said, Buddha has said, don't interfere into anybody's life. I cannot interfere. You must be suffering because of your past karmas. It is not a question that there is no wall. That's why you have fallen, because there are so many people and nobody else has fallen. It is because of your past karmas. You must have thrown somebody in a well in some life. You are suffering for that. And I don't want to interfere, because if I take you out, you will have to fall again somewhere in some time. Buddha has said, never interfere into anybody's life. And he went on his way, perfectly calm and quiet. He thinks he has understood Buddha's message. And he is quoting rightly. All the words are of Buddha's. This also can be the interpretation. And it is not just a story. In India there is a Jaina sect, Therapanth. They say that if you find somebody dying by the side of the road, thirsty, go on your way. Don't interfere. Even if he is dying by thirst and you have a thermos flask and you can give him a little water, don't give. Because he is suffering from his past karmas. Let him finish it. Let him go through it. Otherwise, he will have to go into it again and you will be responsible then. You will be prolonging his suffering. Look at the logic. You will be prolonging his suffering. This time, maybe 2 hours more, and he would have been finished with the karma. You give him water. Now those 2 hours have remained. He will have to account for them. In some other day, in some other life maybe, again he will have to fall by the side of the road, thirsty. You have disturbed his life pattern. And not only that, because you have disturbed his life pattern, you have accumulated a wrong karma for yourself, you will have to suffer. So you have not helped. That's why you will not find a Jaina monk running a hospital or a school. No. That is impossible. People are suffering from diseases because of their past karmas. They have to suffer. Help them to accept. The Jaina monk will say, please, be silent and meditate. And he has the thermos. And he can give the water, but he will not give. So this is not just a story. It has happened in the East. And then comes another man, a Confucian monk. And he looks into the well. And the man says, take me out. Take me out, sir. Otherwise, I will not survive. Few minutes more and I will be gone. And he is shivering and it is cold. And the Confucian says, you don't be worried. We will create a revolution in the world. We will not leave a single stone unturned. We will force the government to make protecting walls around every well. He said, but what is the point of that? That will take years and I will die. And the Confucian says, you are not the question, the society. Individuals come and go. Society remains. Social reform is needed. That every well should have a wall. And this is what the communist says. He says, if you are dying, nothing to be worried. If you are poor, nothing to be worried. Wait when the revolution comes. And communism comes, everything will be okay. You will say that I will die. That is not the point. You are not the question. The question is society. The society has to be changed first. Only when the society is changed, the economic structure is changed, the state, the law is changed, then only people will be happy. Nothing can be done about you. And the Confucian goes, he stands on a high stage and gathers people around him and says to them that a revolution is needed, that every well should have a wall. And the man is dying. Then comes there a Christian missionary. as if he was in search of somebody who has fallen into the well. He looks and says, "My God, good. I was in search. I wanted to serve somebody. You did well." He pulls a rope from his bag. He is carrying it ready-made. He is in search because it is through service. Jesus has said that you have to be the servant of all. He throws the rope in, takes the man out. The man is very happy. The man touches his feet and he says, "You are the real religious person." The Buddhist monk came and he started preaching, and the Confucian came and he has gone and look, there he has gathered a big crowd and he is teaching people about the reform and how the society has to be changed and the law. "You are the only religious person. If you had not come, I would have died. But tell me one thing, why you were carrying the rope? That is strange." And the Christian missionary is very happy because he has done a good work. He says, "I always carry a rope. I carry many things. Because I am always ready. I am a servant." And the man says, "How should I thank you? I would like to do something for you. You have saved me." And the Christian says, "You do only one thing. Teach your children also to go on falling into wells. Because that is the only way to go to God. If people stop falling in wells, if this Confucian fool succeeds, then there will be no opportunity to serve. If this Buddhist monk succeeds in teaching people to accept everything, then there will be no need to serve them. They will not accept service. So just do one thing. Go on falling into wells. Teach your children too. You will be surprised. You will think that this seems to be a little far-stretched. Far-fetched. No, it is not. In India, there is a Hindu Mahatma, Karpatri Ji Maharaj. He has written a book against communism. And the most fundamental question that he has raised is, if there is nobody poor, then religion will disappear. The poor is needed, because only if the poor is there, then you can donate and open hospitals and dharmasalas and things like that. If all poor people disappear, if communism succeeds, then what will happen to religion? Because Hinduism says to donate is the greatest of religion. To share your riches is the greatest thing. But if everybody is rich, then nobody would like to share with your riches. And you won't have riches to share if everybody is equal. If the society becomes communist, then religion will disappear. And this man thinks that he is a religious man. It is not far-fetched. That's how people have understood things. He quotes Vedas and Gita and Upanishads where it is praised that serve the poor, because that is the only way. If you serve the poor, you serve God. But if there is nobody poor, then how you will serve the poor? And how you will serve the God? Then the bridge will be broken. So the logical conclusion is that keep poverty, keep people starving. They are needed. Otherwise, what Mahatmas will do? They won't have anything to do. Down the ages, words of Buddha, Jesus, Mahavir have been misunderstood. Because you have to use your language. And when they use your language, It is always inadequate. And they have no other language. And even if they have another language, they cannot speak it to you because you won't understand. Remember it. Jesus says, if any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all and servant of all. He is simply stating a fact that the man who has understood the ugliness of the ego, the ugliness, violence, poisonousness of ambition, in that very understanding will not compete, will be happy wherever he is. And in that happiness he will see that God is everywhere. And in that very experience that God is everywhere, he will become a servant. Not that he will have to practice. Not that he will have to search where to go and how to serve. Wherever he is, all is God's. And the part is the servant of the whole. There is no deliberate effort to serve. Service comes when you are silent. Service flows from your being when you are happy. Then you are so full of energy that wherever need arises, you serve. A dog is dying and you serve. A tree is drying and nobody has given water and you give water. And you don't go on pretending and posing that you have served. You don't go on shouting to everybody, look how great a servant I am. I have helped this tree to become green again. That is not the point. In helping the tree to be green, you have made your life green. It is already the reward. There is no other reward. In helping the dying dog, you have helped yourself. Because it is all one. When you hit somebody, you are hitting yourself. When you kill somebody, you are killing yourself because we are all one. And when you serve yourself. So there is no need to brag about it. You don't become a great missionary, a great servant of the people, and things like that. You don't become anybody. It all comes natural. When a person is happy, his compassion is natural. Out of happiness, he is compassionate. And he took a child and set him in the midst of them. And when he had taken him in his arms, he said unto them, whosoever shall receive one of such children in my name, receiveth me. And whosoever shall receive me, receiveth not me, but him that sent me. And then Jesus takes hold of a small child. Child is a symbol of helplessness and of innocence. And he says, whosoever shall receive one of such children in my name, wherever you find somebody helpless, help. And wherever you find something innocent, embrace it. Whosoever shall receive one of such children in my name, receiveth me. Jesus says, he has received me. He has opened his heart towards me. In love, you become close to Christ. Jesus is saying, not through competition, not being the first, but in receiving, helping innocence, in receiving life energies that surround you, and in pouring yourself wherever the need arises. You come close to me. And whosoever shall receive me, receiveth not me, but him that sent me. And Jesus said, you don't know about God. You have known me. And you don't know this child. That this innocence of the child is my innocence. In his innocence, my innocence is hidden. And if you go into my innocence, you will find in my innocence, God's innocence is hidden. Look into a flower. Penetrate deep into the heart of the flower, and you will touch Christ. And when Christ is touched, go still a little deeper, and you will touch God. You can touch God in every leaf, and in every drop of water, and in every pebble, in every stone. God is everywhere, just a penetration. And it is not a question of being first, it is a question of being last. It is a question of being egoless. Only then you can respect a child. Otherwise, you will respect a king, not a child. You will respect a rich man, not a helpless child. Have you ever respected a child? If you have not respected a child, you don't know how to respect Christ. You will say, for what? We respect people because they have some capacity. He is a great painter. You respect him. He is Picasso. You respect him. Why? Because he is world famous. Because he has a very famous ego. Because he is somebody. And you would like to be associated with Picasso. This man is a great musician. This man is a great poet. This man is a great philosopher. This man is a great man of God, a Christ, a Buddha. You would like to respect because you would like to come closer. By coming closer to them, you will feel satisfied in your ego. You are so close to Christ. You stand by his side. This is not real respect. A real respect is not for fame, for name. A real respect is a totally different thing. You respect a flower because God is there, fully alive. You respect a bird because God is on the wing. You respect a child because in those eyes is innocence. Those eyes are exactly like Christ. You respect animals, trees, stones, because God is hidden everywhere. His signature is everywhere. Then said the Jews unto him, art thou greater than our father Abraham, which is dead, and the prophets are dead? Whom makest thou thyself? Listening to such words, that if you love a child, respect a child, you have loved me and respected me. And if you have loved me and respected me, you have loved God. The Jews who were standing there must have felt offended. So what this man is claiming? He is claiming that he is God. Who is this man? The son of the carpenter Joseph? Or the son of Mary? And one is not even certain whether he is a legal son, legitimate or illegitimate. Because people say he has born out of Virgin Mary. Maybe he is illegitimate. This illegitimate son of a woman, of an ordinary carpenter, is saying that if you come close to me, you come close to God. He must have looked like a pretender, a deceiver. The Jews must have felt offended. They said, art thou greater than our father Abraham? Because even Abraham has not said that. Even Abraham said that I am just a servant of God. And Jesus says, I am the son of God, not the servant. Jesus really says, I am God. I am in God and God is in me. If you have seen me, you have seen my Father who is in heaven. Are you greater than Abraham, which is dead,
and the prophets are dead. Are you greater than our prophets? Whom makest thou thyself? Who do you think you are? Jesus answered, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. Now, again, there will be difficulty with the language. He is saying exactly what is truth. But the language becomes very, very inadequate. He says, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. And he sighed and was glad. Just think, if I say to you that Jesus is rejoiced to see my day, and he sighed, and he is glad. Now somebody who is a Christian here will feel offended. So who do I think I am? And naturally the question will arise that Jesus' days, 2,000 years have passed. How can he see my day? And how can he rejoice? There is something very symbolic in it. Whenever anybody becomes enlightened, all the enlightened persons, all that energy that has become enlightened before rejoices. Because one more person has come back home. One more person has bloomed. One more person has entered into God. In India there are beautiful stories. When Buddha became enlightened, all the gods showered flowers from the sky. All the enlightened people sang songs around him. That day was the day of great rejoicing. The whole forest bloomed. Trees bloomed out of season. Dead trees sprouted again. There was music and song. And God sang and danced. Because one more has become enlightened. Enlightenment is such a great phenomenon that this should be so. The whole existence should rejoice. But Jesus is saying something which Jews cannot understand. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. And he sighed and was glad. Then said the Jews unto him, thou art not yet 50 years old. And hast thou seen Abraham? Now, two different planes talking to each other. Dialogue seems to be impossible. The Jews are talking about time. And Jesus is talking about eternity. The Jews are talking about the past. And Jesus is talking about the present. He says, before Abraham was, I am. Now he is not talking about Jesus. He is talking about Christ consciousness. Jews are talking about time. He is talking about eternity. Jews are talking about Jesus. And he is talking about Christ. That's the whole difference. Two different planes. Christ consciousness is eternal, timeless. It knows no beginning, no end. It is not confined to time or to periods. Christ consciousness has always been there. Jesus has participated into it now. But once you participate in it, you disappear. It is like a drop of water enters into the ocean. The moment the drop enters the ocean, it is no more there. Now the drop can say, I have been always. Because now it is the ocean saying, not the drop. The river has fallen into the ocean. Jesus has fallen into Christ consciousness. That oceanic feeling. Now he is no more there. Now he is not the son of Mary or Joseph. He is not the carpenter of the village. He is not young. He is not the body. He is not the mind. Now he is the transcendental, Turiya, the fourth state of consciousness. He is Christ. He is Buddha. That's why he uses two different tenses. He says, verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. He does not say, before Abraham was, I was. That will be wrong. That's why this statement is really great. He says, before Abraham was. Abraham he uses as a past tense. Before Abraham was, I am. Before Jesus was, I am. Abraham participated in Christ consciousness and disappeared. So Jesus participated in Christ consciousness and disappeared. Now there is no question of time. Now the time exists not. Now there is no more any time and no more any space. This state is what Buddha calls Nirvana and Jesus calls the kingdom of God. Meditate on these sutras. They are incredible. Go into them and you will be immensely benefited. Great will be your grace if you can understand them.